where the ADMX experiment is, and I'll be telling you about ADMX, and that is to say the Axion Dark Matter experiment. There's a picture of it on the left, sort of going in, and the right coming out. So, just sort of a reminder you all probably don't need, but we'll go through it anyway. There's evidence for dark matter at all scales, starting at the largest scale we can conceive of. Perhaps here you conceive of larger scales, but I can't conceive of much larger than our Hubble volume. And so that, looking at the cosmic microwave background, evidence for stuff that's not normal atoms. Looking at smaller scales, clusters of galaxies, motions of clusters of galaxies indicate there's stuff out there gravitating that's not stars and gas. Even smaller scales, individual galaxies, looking at rotation curves, stars around the center of the galaxy, indication of stuff that's not normal matter. There's something else, something out there, something we call dark matter. And the next natural place to look for it is at the smallest scale of all, is in the laboratory. Hasn't been seen in the laboratory yet, and that's because we have to kind of figure out what it is to know how to look for it. And one good idea comes from QCD, from called the Axion. As you all well know, there's a problem with QCD, the strong CP problem. From my point of view, the problem is pretty simple. It is that we do not measure an electric dipole moment on the neutron. If it's there, it's very, very small, has a magnetic moment, and there's no electric dipole moment. And this kind of implies that the strong force is CP invariant, which would be fine, except there's these terms in the strong Lagrangian that are CP violating, and somehow they all add up to cancel out to a part in 10 to the 10, which is weird. It's not sort of thing that would happen by accident. And so it kind of begs an explanation, and one explanation, perhaps the best explanation, comes from Peche and Quinn, which adds a new symmetry, the Peche-Quinn symmetry, which, when sort of spontaneously broken, makes the CP violation of the strong force cancel out naturally and dynamically. It was pointed out shortly thereafter. This implies the existence of a new particle. That particle was called the Axion. It's a pseudoscalar. And the Axion is also convenient in that for the right parameters, you can make enough axions in the early universe to account for all the dark matter that seems to be out there. And there's, you all probably know about it as the Peche-Quinn symmetry breaking scale. I, of course, think of it as a mass, since I'm an experimentalist. And I'll be talking about what we term the classical window, and that is to say 1 microEV to 1 mEV, which produces enough axions post-inflation to account for all the dark matter. And so it sort of fits the bill in that there's enough. For those masses, axion interactions are extremely weak, and it's produced cold, so structure formation happens in a normal way. So with masses this small, couplings are quite small. You can't decay into anything except photons, and so the experimentally interesting coupling is axion decays into 2 photons. I would be remiss to not point out there are other windows, such as the anthropic window, where axion masses can be different. These may or may not be affected by the observation of the scale of inflation. But I'm going to be focusing on experiments to look for the classical window. And I may not have a good idea of what's natural, so I talked to a theorist I respect at the University of Washington, Ann Nelson, who made this slide, and I stole this slide, who tells me that theories with dark matter axions lie at the intersection of natural theories and theories that are actually viable for explaining our universe. So that's enough motivation for me. So let's look for these axions, dark matter axions. When we do, we look at the accessible parameters of axion-photon coupling in the y-axis here versus axion mass on the x-axis. It's actually a one-parameter theory, so for axions to solve the strong CP problem, these QCD axions, they need to live on this yellow line here where the coupling can vary by no more than an order of magnitude. And if you're trying to make dark matter in the axion, the classical window of axions, then you want to be in this region here. So this solves the strong CP problem and makes dark matter. There's a number of ways to look for axions or axion-like particles. Shown here as solid lines, you can use lasers, light shining through wall experiments. Like that, you can look for axions from the sun with helioscopes, be able to exclude this region. As you can see, these regions exclude particles that may be like axions, but perhaps are a little too strongly coupled to be these true QCD axions, and certainly not the kind in dark matter. To do that, you need a different type of experiment, and that's the RF cavity experiment shown here in green, of which ADMX, the experiment I'm on, is one, and you can see that these are the only way so far to really reach into this axion cold dark matter window. These telescopes, I believe, are, there's two ways you can do it with telescopes. You can look for transparency, where there ought not to be transparency, and then you can look for, I think that's what that particular one is. So, to build these RF cavity experiments, it's easiest to think of this axion to two-photon coupling and say, well, gee, you know, there's a lot of dark matter out there, 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. Axions are extremely light, micro-EV, milli-EV. The number density is so dense that the math is just so much easier. You can just treat it like a classical field. And so you turn a Feynman diagram into a source term in Maxwell's equations and go through the electromagnetics, and you can see that imposing a strong magnetic field lets energy leak from the axion field, the dark matter axion field, into electromagnetic energy. And in practice, you build something called an axion haloscope, as proposed by Pierre Skivy. So it looks like this. You have a big magnet that produces a large magnetic field in here. Axions enter this magnetic field and can convert into photons, sort of at the microwave scale. To help this process along, to enhance the conversion rate, if you make a microwave cavity at the center of this magnet whose resonant frequency is tuned to the frequency photons are producing, you just get a resonant enhancement of how many photons are produced. So when you're building this experiment, you want to get a lot of power out so it's easy to see. You want your cavity to be as large as possible. Bigger cavity, more dark matter, more axions, more power coming out. You want your magnetic field to be high as possible, larger, the conversion rate goes as b squared. And you want a high cavity Q, that is to say you want your resonance to be very sharp, you want a lot of resonant enhancement. You're going to be looking for this signal over a thermal background, over black body radiation of the cavity and electronic noise, and so you want your experiment to be as cold as possible, and you want your first stage electronics to be as quiet as possible. They're also sort of a cold, low noise temperature. So an implementation of this is ADMX, the axion dark matter experiment. Here is the large superconducting magnet we use arriving at its home at SEMPA at the University of Washington. Here's a number of our collaborators. We're probably going to be adding to this list as the Gen 2 dark matter search begins. Here's what it looks like on the inside in a cutaway view. So there's that big magnet. There's the coil. Inside of that, we put a microwave cavity. This whole thing is kept very cold, cryogenic temperatures. At first 4 Kelvin, then 2 Kelvin, then 1 Kelvin, and we'll talk about going even colder. Antennas are at the top to pull out the signal. Above that is space for refrigeration. A lot of this space up here is dedicated to the low-noise cryogenic amplifiers, actual quantum amplifiers, that require their own field cancellation, which has a second magnet that sits in there. Above that, simply baffling and insulation to keep the whole thing cold. There it is. We call this thing on the outside the main magnet, and this the experimental insert. It comes out, and here it is. This is actually it going in. So there's the microwave cavity with some shields on. That's where we keep the amplifiers. And is the resonance of this distracting? Maybe I shouldn't poke it. So back to a cartoon drawing again to talk about where the signal path goes, the ADMX receiver. So here's the magnet. Axions come in, turn into photons in the microwave cavity, bounce around in the cavity, come out this antenna, get amplified by low-noise cryogenic amplifiers. These are at sort of gigahertz frequencies for my micro-EV-ish axions. The cavity bandwidth is maybe 25 kilohertz. And so you have what is a double heterodyne receiver, something a lot like a very fancy AM radio, that moves your frequency from a gigahertz down into the kilohertz band where you can digitize it. You digitize, get voltage versus time, take a Fourier transform, make a power spectrum, and now you're saying how much power is coming out of my cavity. And you're looking on the power spectrum here, power versus frequency, for lumps and bumps that could be excess power coming from dark matter axions converting inside your cavity. And you'll see that a plot again, bigger.
Frequencies in kilohertz,
Frequency, kilohertz, minus 816 megahertz. It's inconvenient, but since you're starting at gigahertz and you subtract off these local oscillators, that's a common way of doing it, is you're saying, I'm looking at this very small frequency band that's been offset by a huge amount. So you may see that a lot in these plots. So we don't know what the axion mass is to within a few orders of magnitude, and yet I've told you the cavity bandwidth is 25 kilohertz. So 25 kilohertz, and we're covering many gigahertz. It has to be tuned. The way we tune the cavity is with two baseball bat-sized tuning rods. If you look at this picture here, this is the microwave cavity with the top taken off. This pair of hands is holding the tuning rods there. They move from the outside to the inside in motions like this. And to look at the effect on the frequency, we use a plot we call a mode map. It's a little complicated. So this is measuring transfer function through the cavity versus frequency as we move the rods. So the y-axis is frequency. The x-axis is where the rod is. In this case, it's going from the center to the edge to the center again. And the color indicates how much power gets through. So lighter colors indicate a lot of power is getting through. That's on a resonant frequency. Darker colors, no power is getting through. It's not on a resonant frequency. And so the resonant modes follow paths like this as the rods are tuned. And you can see that in general, as you move towards the center of the cavity, most of the frequencies go up.
This is a simulation.
This is... Nope, this one was this is a real... This is, you actually just measure it. So it takes about 8 hours to go around the whole thing. And this is just one of the rods.
Have you been doing frequent calibration of that? Like, how do you know that map doesn't shift?
So we do this probably every 3 months, I would say, is it's made. It's made warm and then it's made cold. It doesn't shift very much. And we, during data taking, we actually, for the region where we're actively looking at, every time the rods move, you remap, every time you've moved the rods, you take a scan in frequency space through this to locate, to make sure you are on the resonant frequency. Because you can see there are a lot of different resonant modes in this cavity, and not all of them couple to the axion. In fact, very few of them do. You're looking for the sort of maximum overlap between the photon wave function and the axion dark matter wave function, which is sort of a broad thing. And most of these have nodes, and most of them have zero coupling to axions. The one that we use primarily is what we call the TM010. It goes from there to about there. So it's one of the lower ones. And here's a simulation of what it looks like inside the cavity with no rods. This is sort of the simplest no-node mode that you can think of. So it has good overlap. It's not the only one that couples, but it's the one that couples the best. So I mentioned the amplifiers, and I should go on a bit of digression to talk about them. This is an enabling technology for the experiment, because the amplifiers we use, these quantum limited amplifiers, have very low noise temperature. So here's a plot of noise temperature, that is to say how much electronic noise is added by the amplifiers we use, versus their physical temperature, shown here. We're right now using SQUID amplifiers, and SQUID amplifiers follow this curve down here. So as you cool them below a Kelvin, they continue to drop in noise temperature down to what's called the quantum limit, which for our frequencies is around 100 millikelvin. Previously, say 2006 version of this experiment used HFET amplifiers whose noise temperature was stuck a little past our ceiling here at 2 Kelvin. So these amplifiers have really lowered our noise temperature, and that's greatly enhanced our sensitivity. And so right now we're using SQUID amplifiers. For higher frequencies, we'll be using Joseph and parametric amplifiers. These are all devices that look like this in an electron microscope, where they've got these Josephson junctions. I believe there's actually a talk later on today that deals with superconducting electronics.
So what I suppose I'm taking this plot is that the noise temperature drops linearly with bath temperature until you reach around 100
Yes.
And that's going to saturate?
Yes. So this is going to answer a question you might have later when I say, okay, we really need to cool our experiment to 100 millikelvin. And you'd say, well, why 100? Why not 10? Well, the answer is the amplifiers. It's not worth improving the temperature much beyond this. So this is a fundamental quantum limit on this particular type of amplifier. Yeah?
Is this associated with a standard quantum limit, or is that a different thing?
Standard quantum limit.
What is the
standard quantum
limit?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I mean, it's a nomenclature term, so I have to, is that?
Yeah, I just look for what I want to look this up later.
Yeah, it's where you get that you can, you know, you have an uncertainty of half a photon per bandwidth.
Right.
So that's, yeah. So with amplifiers like these, we can achieve exquisite sensitivity and power. So this is a plot of uncertainty and power, delta P over P, as a function of number of integrations, or you can think of this as integration time. As we continue to integrate, this is not surprising, your sensitivity increases, your uncertainty decreases as root T down to a point where it levels off, where you're systematically limited. For us, we are systematically limited at a power of 1/100th of a yocto watt. Yocto is the bottom of the SI prefix scale, and so we're not limited. We're not 10 of anything. We have to be 1/100th of a yocto watt. Characteristic axion power at our frequencies is about 100 yocto watts, so we have more than enough sensitivity already to be able to detect even pessimistically coupled axions.
For those of us not familiar with wild-breeding animals, what is a yocto watt?
So that's 10 to the minus 24, because that's 10 to the minus 20. Yeah, I think that's what it's down. So a hundredth of that, 10 to the minus 26 is the hundredth of the octawatt. Right, so the issue is we've got great sensitivity. However, the caveat is this is a 30 days of integration at one point, at one 25 megahertz or 25 kilohertz band of a cavity. We have a long way to go. We can't afford to spend 30 minutes at every single point. So while we have excellent sensitivity, there's an issue of you trade sensitivity for how fast can you scan over frequency range. And our scanning looks a little like this. The idea is you move your rods to a certain position, you sweep the cavity to, yes?
Sorry, can I ask one more
question? Sure.
So in the plot of the map, you actually show there are several resonances, right?
There are several resonances.
Is there a way to take advantage of that? And basically, as you scan, you're getting information about more than one resonance?
Please wait 15 slides, and we'll get into that. Right. So rods move, sweep the cavity, find the resonant frequency, integrate about 100 seconds at that resonant frequency, make a power spectrum, get one of these, tick, 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 tick. Move the rods ever so slightly, find the resonant frequency, integrate, tick, 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 over and over and over and over, day in and day out. Till at the end of the day, you can add all these powers up and get a power spectrum for a wide range of frequencies, and you're looking for excess of power that could be an axion. There's excesses of power that could be things other than axions. We're looking over a wide range. There's lots of bins in this plot. There will be statistical fluctuations that will just fluctuate up, look like a little bit extra power. There could also be external signals. Someone is using a cell phone while one of the temperature sensors is unplugged. It can pick up that signal, carry it down to the cavity. Fortunately, it's fairly easy to identify these signals because we can, at the end of the week, we look over our power spectra, we look for what we call candidates, places that have excess power that could be an axion, and we move the rods back to be scanning over that frequency range, and we sit there and integrate for a long time. Statistical fluctuations decrease in significance as you integrate on them, so that's clearly not an axion. Things like cell phones tend to come and go, and that's also not an axion because dark matter is around us all the time. And so far, no signals have persisted. If they did, beyond that, the next thing to do is to turn the magnet down. And the signal power should go as the magnet power squared if it's an axion. And the sort of thing we're looking for is this. So this is, once again, a power spectrum, power versus frequency. This is simulated data. So this is Monte Carlo stuck onto real noise. And I've got actually, these are two axions here that are the same model of axion, same coupling. But they're two different models of how dark matter behaves in our galaxy, what sort of the typical velocities are, what its temperature are. Over here is what we call thermalized dark matter. This is probably the most vanilla isothermal halo model you can think of. On the left is a colder than typical dark matter model. Both are plausible. We have to make an experiment sensitive to both of them. And so we look for both of these sorts of things. In general, we're a little more sensitive to models like the one on the left because they have a bit higher signal to noise. So, putting all this together, the most recent results we've released are shown here in axion-photon coupling versus axion mass. Here, maybe you're more interested, this is a cumulative all of ADMX up to 2010, showing that we've covered several microEV at the more optimistically coupled axion range. These KSVZ and DFSZ are sort of an optimistic and pessimistic coupling. And so this is good. We had some chance of finding the axion. We did not see any signs of an axion, so we were able to exclude a small region up here. That's where we were in 2010. And before I get into where we're going now, I'd like to take a little interlude of other light particles that we can look for with ADMX. We've done a few test studies of looking for more exotic things. For example, paraphotons, dark photons, hidden sector photons, these things, there's sort of lots of names for the same thing, mostly because there's an enormous energy scale range that you could be looking for, enormous coupling scale, and so these are a new U1, so something like a photon, but not a photon, very weakly kinetically mixing with it. There's a lot of experiments on here. I won't go over them except to say a lot of ideas, a lot of experiments, and ADMX lives kind of here in the microEV mass range. The experiment works like so. You have a cavity sitting outside. Here, you pump as much power as you can into it. Photons resonate around inside. If there's kinetic mixing with hidden photons are emitted from this cavity. Some of those hidden photons go into, here's the top of the experiment, some of them go down and convert back into regular photons in the microwave cavity and are detected as excess power, just like an axion search. So ADMX required no modifications on the inside to be used as hidden sector photon search. Well, all we needed was an extra cavity on the outside. Another even more exotic. No. You could, but we didn't, just because we have talked about in the future actually setting it up and doing during our full scan, searching for both axions and paraphotons at the same time. Because so the danger is you see a signal and you've discovered something, you don't know, did you discover axions or paraphotons? Such a dilemma to be in, if only. Yeah, and then the answer is you go, you've got your signal, you go, you flick off the emitter cavity, and then you know. It's true. Right, so another exotic particle that we did a search for is called a chameleon, which are interesting things. They have very interesting properties, and the particular chameleons we were looking for may or may not be relevant for dark energy. And they have these interesting properties where their mass is dependent upon the amount of matter around them. So we're looking for things that might have large mass in solid matter, so they wouldn't want to go through a steel wall, but a small mass in vacuum, and so they would be able to be stuck in a vacuum vessel. And these are necessary to avoid being detected already in short-range gravity experiments anyway. And then if we posit, well, this is also coupled to photons, this is something we can look for in ADMX, and the process is you pump a bunch of power into the cavity, so photons are bouncing around, some of them mix with chameleons. Chameleons are also trapped in the cavity because they have this mass difference between their being in the vacuum and the matter. And so it's actually mixing between the photon modes and the chameleon modes in the cavity. You turn off the source, and then as the chameleons mix back into photons, there would be an afterglow. So there'd be photons that keep appearing in the cavity even though you've turned off your source. And so this is an experiment you cannot do while you're doing an axion search because it involves injecting power into the main cavity, then switching your amplifier back on and looking for a while. And so here are the results from these two searches. On the left, the hidden photon search. So this is sort of a zoom in of that big plot I showed you before. And ADMX was competitive with an indirect search looking for deviations of Coulomb's law. And future versions of ADMX should be able to push down several orders of magnitude below that. And here we're a little tiny peak because we're looking at a single frequency to do this experiment. if we move to being move to doing this experiment while we're looking for axions, we'll be sort of at this bottom, we'll be at the bottom of this peak, and that we swept over a range, the range we scan over. On the right, we were able to exclude a range of these of chameleon photon couplings over an extremely small range of masses. You sort of have to know what mass you're looking for ahead of time because you need the exact overlap between the chameleon and photon modes. But for that mass, we were much more sensitive than the existing experiments, these Fermilab experiments, which were sort of a wide mass range. So mostly it's proof of principle. ADMX can be configured to search for other light hidden sector hidden sector particles. So if you've got any good ideas, please talk to me.
Why was this particular mass range? Well, essentially not in the range. This mass was chosen for that.
So you're saying why did we pick 1.9515 EV? No, 1.9515 EV picked us. We had built a cavity to look for axions, and so we had to back calculate and say what are the chameleon modes on the in this, and what's the what would be the exact difference in energy, and so that would be the mass you'd be looking for. So it's entirely because we were using existing hardware. If someone were to name the chameleon mass, then I could probably build a cavity to go look for it, assuming it's in the micro EV range.
One quick question about the paraphoton surface. How difficult is it to tune the two cavities to be exactly on resonance?
In ADMX, it is quite easy.
Okay.
So this is something that depends on the Q of your cavity. I can go on a sort of a digression here. And with ADMX, you do not want a cavity with a Q higher than 10 to the 6 because the expected line width of the axion is 10 to the 6 because they have a certain temperature. And that's something you can line up. If you have two cavities with 10 to the 6 Q, you can line them up. Cavities with 10 to the 9 Q are harder to line up. But that's we're not there yet because that wouldn't be quite so useful for axions. Okay, so that's going to be my end of other exotic particles. I'm going back to axions here, and so where we left off, we were in 2010, we'd set some limits over a small range of axion masses, sort of optimistic couplings. Where do we go from there? Well, ADMX was selected in the US Gen 2 Dark Matter Search Program to be one of the experiments that pushes forward, and so we're greatly expanding our aspirations. We aspire to go from on our axion-photon coupling plot here, to go from this blue region, which is what we've covered already, to covering this green region, which is to say covering a very wide range of masses, plausible masses, at even pessimistic couplings, even below that. So we're looking at pessimistically coupled dark matter, where maybe not all of it's made of axions, maybe half of it's made of axions. We're hoping to do that over the next few years. It's a fairly rapid scan rate. And so this begs the question, how do we go, if this took a decade to do, how do we go to this sort of scan rate? And the answer has to do with temperature. You, of course, could buy a bigger magnet, which is, the cost scales with the field faster than the scan speed scales, unfortunately. Or you can go down in temperature. Because you want a higher signal to noise means you can scan much more quickly. It turns out the scan speed, and sort of the speed frequency per time, goes as the square of the noise temperature inversely. That is to say, if you can just drop your noise by a factor of 10, you can scan 100 times faster. So we need to run colder. And recall that our noise temperature is both the physical temperature of the system plus the amplifier temperature. And since I showed you that plot earlier that our quantum limited amplifiers can go down to 100 millikelvin. It's clear the task now is to get our physical temperature down to that temperature. And we're going to do that by adding a dilution refrigerator to the system. Previously, we used pumped helium-4, and we're going to a helium-3, helium-4 mixture in a device that looks like this. This is nice because, so previously I've shown this slide and there was a picture here of the generic model of dilution refrigerator. This is the actual one that's going in the experiment being built right now. And to give you a graphical feel of why we're doing this, here's a plot of scan speed and sort of arbitrary units versus the physical temperature of the experiment. Back in 2006, we were using HFET amplifiers at 2 Kelvin, and we lived on this red line. That is to say, as we cooled down, we were rapidly limited in our scan speed by the temperature of the amplifiers. In our 2010 run, we kept the same refrigeration method, but we moved to quantum limited amplifiers. We scanned a little bit faster, but we moved to this blue line. And so now that we're on this blue line, it's very worthwhile to cool the experiment further to be able to scan much, much faster. We're hoping to do that very soon. This is a non-trivial task. This is actually a lot of cooling power, because you're not cooling like a little tiny chip to 100 millikelvin. You're cooling a giant chunk of copper. And there's one other way that we can improve our scan speed, and this, all right, so here's the answer to your question. There are other modes that couple to axions beside the TM010 that we typically use. The whole TM0N0 modes, family of modes, all couple to axions, though the higher n goes, it's sort of 1 over n squared in terms of their coupling. Graphically, so there's the 010, all of the E field is pointing in the same direction. The 020, you've got a strong channel of E field in the center, and then it kind of changes direction on the edge. And so for here, you get all of this volume. Here, you get maybe most of the volume in the center to give an idea of the relative power. If you get, for every 1 unit of power you get in the 010, you get about half as much in the 020. What is convenient is the 020 is a higher frequency than the 010, and so you can potentially be scanning with both modes at once. It is technically challenging, however, because as you saw in that mode map, modes kind of go everywhere, and then the question is, can you tune and simultaneously take data in a useful way in both modes? And that's something we're working on. And we have, we've actually demonstrated that we can take data in both modes, and now it's just down to, is it worth going through the extra effort to scan in both modes at once? Does that actually improve our scan speed? So we've been working on this refrigeration in the extra modes over the last year, actually the last 4 years, because first we moved the experiment to the University of Washington, rebuilt the insert scratch. And quite recently, this is this spring, we did cold commissioning without the extra refrigeration stage. So here's the insert going into the bore. There's the insert coming out of the bore cold during our cold commissioning. It was successful. We did a lot of debugging. We did a lot of new calibrations that didn't exist before. I'll just show a few of them off here. Here is a demonstration of our quantum limited amplifiers. Before, we would have the amplifiers tested where they were made, and we got a number to say, oh yes, at this temperature they have this, they add this much electronic noise, they add this much electronic noise temperature. And we trusted that and just wrote it into the calculations. It would be reasonable to ask, well, are you sure they're working right? Now we know, because we can take data and make plots like this in situ. This is with the amplifier installed in the system in between data taking runs, and we're able to measure both the gain and the noise temperature of our squid amplifier over a frequency range. And so this can be done every week or so to check that our amplifier is still working optimally. This was done at a higher temperature, of course, we don't have the refrigeration installed, but we were able to say, okay, yes, this is where it's got the best noise temperature, it's got plenty of gain, and so this is something that we're very happy to be able to measure in situ. It sort of lowers our systematic uncertainties. Another calibration that we have that we didn't have in previous experiments is artificial axion signals. So here is raw data coming out of the cavity, power versus frequency, just noise. Here's the same raw data with this peak. And this is not Monte Carlo being added. This is the axion line width being predicted from theory, being fed into a signal generator, fed down a cable, down into the experiment, into the bottom of the cavity in a little tiny, very weakly coupled antenna. So this puts power into the cavity exactly like an axion would. And so this signal has gone through all of our receiver chain, all of our digitization, all of our cuts. And so in the future, when we say we have a 95% confidence limit, that means when we put 100 of these signals in, our analysis picked out 95 of them.
For an axion signal, it's the same as the efficiency for an antenna for a fed-in signal?
So we calibrate it to power, in particular noise temperature. So you have a level, I mean, so yes, there's kind of an arbitrary amount of gain. You know the gain of your amplifiers, you know your cables, but these can change cryogenically. So you can calibrate your signal source in with just a tone and say, okay, well, I know that I'm getting KTB power out, and here I'm putting this, you know, 20 dBm, and I get a signal this tall, okay, I can turn it down, turn it down, turn it down. Okay, now I have a calibration of power into the cavity versus power out, and I can feed it an actual axion line width. So just to show off a little more data that we took this summer in a data-taking run, of course, quite preliminary. These are the two plots that we look at every day to say, how is the scan going? The top is signal-to-noise. So this is asking the question, if there was an axion there in the data we've taken so far, how significant would that axion be as a function of frequency? And what's going on here is we started up the system. We sat at one frequency for a while, built up signal to noise. We began the tuning system, moved over frequency. So this is many, many 100-second events. This is sort of weeks of data all the way over here. At this point, we said, OK, well, what if we wanted more signal to noise? We reversed the tuning system and began working back this way and got about this far before we took a snapshot of the picture. And so once we've got enough signal to noise, we say, OK, this is now it's worthwhile saying, are there any axions there? And so then we look at this, what we call a candidate search plot. And so this is the excess power that could be from axions as a function of frequency. You notice this is an entirely different channel. This was actually the 020 mode, interestingly enough. You can see it's up past a gigahertz. This is back to the 010 mode, down at 600 megahertz. And so we look at this for excess power that looks like an axion. In this case, there was none. But had there been, we would have flagged it and gone back to that frequency and spent a lot more time integrating to see was it statistical or not. I think that's intentionally blurred out because I didn't want to give anyone ideas about how far we were along with different amplifiers and different channels and things. So it was one of these things. It's I really want to show the data and the collaboration has to check off on things. It's just easier if I blur it out. Right. Okay. So I've shown you some actual data, and this is going to be very, very exciting once we install our refrigeration, because these blurred numbers will become much, much larger blurred numbers, and then we'll probably go through the process of checking them off and being like, okay, now we're starting to exclude regions. So the overall schedule is, back in 2010 when we finished taking data, we spent the next 3 years redesigning, sort of anticipating our new refrigeration stage, moved it to University of Washington, where the experiment is now. This spring, we did our commissioning. This summer, we did a short run at about 1 Kelvin to verify that we did have the data taking together. Our analysis is ready. We want it so that as soon as this refrigerator arrives, we can just go gangbusters and start looking for axions. So right now, the experiment is warming up. I think probably before I take my flight back, the students will pull it out and begin the process of retrofitting it for the dilution refrigerator, which is under construction. I guess it's actually under testing right now. It should be delivered this winter. We will install it. And very shortly, very early in 2015, we hope to have it commissioned and taking data 100 millikelvin, so running deeper sensitivity much faster over a wide range of frequencies. So that's where we're aiming. And then there's the question of, well, in our plan here, we're leaving some frequencies for, say, Gen 3. And how do we get to these higher frequencies? And what do we do if we actually need to get to lower frequencies? And I'd like to spend some slides talking about our R&D program. Our R&D program actually goes, it sort of starts here. This is several years in advance, so we have to get these cavities working. But we hope to push all the way at some point to the entire plausible axion mass range. And it's hard. There's a number of reasons that it's hard to get to higher masses. As you go up in frequency, the photon wavelength goes down. The characteristic cavity size goes down. The amount of dark matter you fit in your cavity goes down. Your power goes down. It takes longer to scan. Qs get lower because the surface to volume ratio of the cavity gets smaller. Q goes down, less power, lower signal noise, takes longer to scan, harder. And the amplifier noise, this quantum noise limit, or I guess the standard quantum limit, increases with frequency. And so your signal noise goes down, takes longer to scan. So everything is getting harder. I suppose one nice thing is that the expected axion photon coupling goes up. Lower axion masses, they're also harder for a different reason. Here your characteristic wavelength is getting bigger, and so you'd like to build a bigger cavity. But would you actually like to, your cavity doesn't fit in your magnet anymore, so you go and ask for money to build a 2-meter bore 8 Tesla, 15 Tesla magnet, and that's expensive. So maybe it's more expensive than hard. Also, the axion photon coupling as you get goes down as you get to lower masses. So sort of everything is hard. Fine. We've got R&D underway to address all of these problems. So in terms of resonant structures, we are looking for ways to reclaim the lost volume, because instead of just taking, oh, we're going to take this little tiny baby cavity and put it in our big magnet, can't we take our current cavity and make it so it has a higher frequency mode that couples to axions? And so there's studies underway about, well, can we divide the cavity and look at combine the modes in both sides in an intelligent way? Can we divide it into 4 sections maybe? Are there more exotic tuning mechanisms like vanes that will get us to those frequencies or even posts? There's some, or, you know, is, are there more efficient ways where you can have one cavity that would sort of a Matryoshka doll cavity like going on here? Are there more exotic coatings we can do to get higher Qs? These are all things under study right now at among our various collaborators. Lower frequency resonant structures. This problem we may actually have solved. And it turns out that by changing the end caps of a cavity, you can change its resonant frequency, make it lower. So here's the machine drawing. Here's what it looks like when you actually make the thing and test it. And here's what you get in the test. The blue line is a standard right circular cylinder cavity. That's the mode you want at 1.8 gigahertz. We were using test cavities, yay big. When you put these machined in caps on, you can decrease the frequency of that mode considerably. And so we may be able to use these machined in cap cavities to reach lower frequencies without having to buy a new magnet.
The higher harmonics. The signal.
I think you may have to explain that to me after the talk to get into exactly how to do that. Okay. But we should sit down and talk about it. It's not something obvious to me.
Well, if you just generally if you have one frequency, you normally recite the higher frequencies as well, whether it's through the coupling or in the fluid itself.
That's totally an after talk kind of discussion thing. It'd be sort of new. But no, that's a good idea. We should talk about it. Right, so now we're on to even higher frequency resonant structures, moving away from cavities. So one thing about cavities is you lose energy in the walls. Why not throw the walls away? Have an open resonator. Have something like a Fabry-Perot cavity. And what's more, why use sort of the lowest mode? Why not arrange your magnetic field such that the magnetic field in combination with the mode couples to axions maximally? And that's the idea here. You have something like a Fabry-Perot resonator. Inside, the red line would be one of the modes. If you arrange your magnetic field so that you're always pointing the same, you arrange your magnetic field so it changes direction with the mode structure of the resonance, then you get coupling to axions and you get the entire volume and you can make it as large as you want up to the wavelength of the axion, which is sort of hundreds of meters. So you could actually make a very big experiment and couple axions at a very high frequency using this technique. And so this idea we have taken from just sort of a blackboard sketch to actually building a prototype. Here's the prototype, both the machine drawing and the actual thing. And so here are reflectors for the Fabry-Perot system. Here are wires being suspended. We run current through these wires to generate magnetic fields. So you have to line up the resonant mode with the magnetic fields from these wire planes. The process of taking data is much like the big ADMX. You move the reflectors to a certain distance apart. You use this device here, measure the transfer function, say, okay, the resonant frequency I want is right here. You write that down, you flick that off, you flick on your spectrum analyzer, take a power spectrum at that frequency, look for excess power from axions converting on your benchtop here. And so this is something we did with a team of students to demonstrate this technique is workable, and we were able to actually set a exclusion range on axion photon coupling. So this is a paper sort of in the submission process right now. And so this is a much higher mass range. So this has gone from micro EV, which the big ADMX is, to 70 something micro EV. And the excluded range is, well, it's pretty good for a benchtop prototype. It's competitive with, say, this Fermi, Gamev and Alps at Fermilab at DAISY are these laser light shining through walls experiments looking for axions. And it's kind of interesting, you know, big accelerated experiments competing with a little benchtop thing. However, it's clear that if you really want to look for dark matter axions, you have about 8 orders of magnitude to go. But that's kind of okay, because this is just a benchtop, and we think we understand how these things scale. For our benchtop experiment, the noise temperature was 1,500 degrees Kelvin, dominated by the amplifier, because it's an off-the-shelf amplifier. You could imagine going to sort of Kelvin or even sub-Kelvin temperatures with low-noise cryogenic amplifiers. The Q, the resonant quality, was not that good. It was sort of polished in the machine shop aluminum at room temperature, if you were to make it. Cryogenic would be much higher. The magnetic field was pathetic, frankly. It's the best you can generate with copper wire wound. If you move to superconducting wire, we could get that field to be much higher. And the volume was modest. You could imagine scaling that up by a factor of 10. And you sort of can get an order and a half of magnitude out of improvements to each of these, which would add up to be able to reach down here. You could imagine if you sort of pushed technology to the limit, building an experiment that might be able to cover a range like this. So this range here, these plots that I've been showing, so this is ADMX published data, ADMX Gen 2 will go up to about here, so this range is sort of already spoken for. But we're hoping that this R&D idea will gradually grow to the point where it's time to talk about Gen 3 designs. This could be an ADMX Gen 3 idea. So this is kind of my pet project that I'm showing off, is directions we can go to make it clear that we're not, you know, once we explore, say, maybe the most likely axion dark matter mass ranges, we're going to be ready to look for even unlikely to the point where we've covered the whole region. Just to talk about a few other R&D ideas, one could imagine, if one didn't want to make this magnetic field change direction, you can actually modify the modes that you're looking at to couple maximally to axions. So here's an idea using a cavity or, say, a waveguide with multiple nodes in it. Through careful strategic placement of dielectrics, you can make the resonant structure look like this in 3D or this in 2D, so electric field versus position. In this case, the coupling to axion is given by just integrate the E field dot B field. And so if you had a B field like this, you'd integrate over this, you'd get, you know, not a bad number, as opposed to if these dielectric pieces weren't here, in which case you'd integrate, you get half up, half down, and get zero. So this is an idea of modifying modes to be able to couple to axions at higher frequencies. And we'll see how that works out. Another idea, even more exotic, is to move from passive resonators to active resonators. This is where you're taking, say, your cavity. Much of the power is lost in the walls. Some of the power comes out. Instead of just sending that off to be measured, you amplify it and feed some of it back into the cavity. So it goes all the way around here. And you additionally phase shift it so that signals here will be in phase when they get added back here. This is actually a fairly old technology. This was something they used before they had good filters to make a good filter. And you can see we've set up with one of our cavities. We can go from a low Q system to a very high Q, highly resonant system. And so the idea is that this would increase the phase space for axions to convert into your system. It also increases your noise. And so it's a technical challenge to set this up in a way that you increase your signal to noise as you turn your active resonator up. So that's something being developed right now, and we'll see how it goes. There is no particular frequency range that this would be bad for. This is something that you could imagine, if we get this working in the near term, this could go into Gen 2 ADMX in 6 months and just make everything sort of 10 times better. Failing that, it could go into higher frequencies. The current Gen 2 ADMX is really, we've got a baseline where we can cover down to the more pessimistic couplings. This would probably be most exciting for the higher frequencies where you're losing Q and you want a way to get that Q back. This could get that Q back. Okay, so I've wandered off into R&D land, and so let's come back and sort of conclude about ADMX and axions. Overall, axions are, they still are, a well-motivated dark matter candidate. Are we going to find them? Yes, we're going to find axions. provided they're out there, because the Gen 2 ADMX experiment is set to cover a large range of the plausible axion masses, and even if they're not seen then, there, we are undergoing, we're doing an R&D program to be able to cover all plausible axion masses at even more pessimistic couplings, even when they're not all of dark matter. And so we hope to be able to give a conclusive answer to the question, is dark matter made of axions?
Can you go back two slides to the you showed projected sensitivities for sort of the higher frequency ranges?
Mm-hmm.
A, B, C, and D's benchmark points. So two questions. Does it go to higher frequency than what it's shown? And what went into those expected sensitivities? Was it just rescaling like you talked about?
There's two separate questions. So question one. Let's start with question two first. Question two first is how do we come up with these numbers? We sat down and said, if money were not an object, what could we build? And this is about what we thought. There's some interesting things are the magnetic field. As you get to higher magnetic field, if you have wire planes, you eventually will snap the wire planes. So there's limitations on that until you get small enough that you're actually printing these things on circuits, at which point you can be a lot more sturdy. Volume at the highest axion masses, you start running into the axion wavelength starts becoming sort of 10 meters in scale. And so if you were saying, well, I'm just going to take a building and make a 50 meter long thing, that no longer works. So you need to make it the same as the axion wavelength. And then noise temperature, this is assuming quantum limited amplifiers at frequencies up to 120 gigahertz, which may be optimistic, but people I've talked to who build these amplifiers say it's not fundamentally impossible. It's not like this is above the Josephson frequency. So those are some of the things that went into these numbers. We said, okay, how big would we have to make it to get sensitivity that's definitive and to say that we would cover all the axion mass range. Higher frequencies, at some point, there is a question of your magnetic field of can you print circuits with the feature size necessary to make these magnetic fields that change every half wavelength. And I just don't know enough about it to say that it can't be done.
So 10 to the minus 3 EV
would be extreme. At 10 to the minus 3, you might want to start looking at other technologies pretty hard, but I'm not going to say this won't do it because I haven't gone and said, what's the smallest feature size. Oh, perhaps I should have gone into that further. Oh, and I don't have my, okay, well, there's a plot that I should have had in my spares. If you want, I can show it to you later, but I'll give a verbal explanation. So, for one, to change the resonant frequency, this thing's on a little cart, and you move it back and forth. So that changes the resonant frequency. That's easy. The hard part is, if your resonant frequency does not line up, as you change it away from sort of the optimal frequency where these occur every half wavelength, you lose axion sensitivity. In this particular setup, where we operated at 17 and 18 gigahertz, the cart could be moved to scan about 1 gigahertz before it was necessary to take the wires out and space the wire planes differently to maintain a good axion coupling. In a full-scale experiment, if you want to do this in an automated way, you would probably put piezoelectrics between the wire planes, and as you move one of the reflectors, you would be sort of pushing the wire planes out in a breathing motion. Yeah, but it is possible to scan a non-negligible amount without moving the wire planes, as long as you take into account the fact that as you get away from the central frequency, you have to spend more time because your sensitivity is going down. So it's in this case, Q doesn't actually come into it because it has to do entirely with, so you've got the magnetic field, you've got the electric field of the resonance, and so it's simply a shape, it's a geometric calculation. It has nothing to do with Q. However, as the wires are no longer at nodes, they can suck up power, and so the Q does go down a little bit. That's something we measured. We're hoping that sort of that is less of a problem with superconducting wires because they're less likely to, then you have only scattering and not actual absorption.
So with your green region, already excluded by AMX, why does that have gaps in it and jaggedy bottoms? I've seen this like a few times, and it's never.
Oh, let's go find one. This one?
The last one.
Oh, the last one, okay.
A, B, C, D.
Oh, yes.
And then the green, like what you've currently done, has these two big gaps in it, and then all the jaggediness at the bottom.
In that case, if that's the impression you're getting, then I'm being a little unfair to experiments that came before ADMX. So, the green is the class of cavity experiments. ADMX is this one that reaches down into the KSVZ axion range. These are actually previous experiments. Rochester, Brookhaven, Fermilab, and, oh my, the name's escaping me. Apologies. I'm selling someone short here. Sort of precursors to ADMX cavity experiments that were operated early that didn't reach into the dark matter range. And I was, for this plot, I was grouping them all together in cavity experiments just to say, look, this is kind of what's been done with cavities. But I point out ADMX, of course, because that's kind of the leader.
Yeah. I think one of the thoughts you show that in the virilizer tapes, the signal significance is much worse. Can you explain more about that?
Oh, yes. I would love to talk about this at great length. Where are we talking about? All right, so here's the simulations. Okay, so in the virialized case, your axion line width gets broader. And it's simply thermal broadening because the frequency corresponds to exactly the total energy of the axion turned into a photon. And if they're hot, then you're getting the mass energy plus kinetic energy. And since there is a relative velocity between you and the particle, if they're coming at you, you get a slightly higher frequency. If they're moving away from you, you get a slightly lower frequency. And so if they're hotter, that's broadened, and that generates this sort of thing here. And this is, in some ways, a little unfair to talk about signal to noise, because here, if it's this broad, you actually rebin to say, well, I'm going to combine, you know, my full signal to noise is every four bins combined. And while this one is really only one bin wide, and so you get the full signal of noise here. And then there are interesting cases of if you like the idea that axions could form a Bose-Einstein condensate, in that case they have a very, you know, they're kind of infinitely thin, or you know, thin up to the point that we can measure it, in which case you want to rebend this so that you have extremely fine bins and you get excellent signal of noise even if there's just a very small number of axions in a Bose-Einstein condensate. From another perspective, if you want to do dark matter astronomy and you're saying, hey, I think that there's a thermal population of dark matter, and then there's maybe a late infall or maybe a capture population of dark matter, and they have different temperatures, you would see that because once you find the axion, you go sit on it for a month. And so this noise level just drops away. And you have this very nice shape. And from that shape, you can do axion astronomy. If it's all isothermal, then it has a Maxwellian distribution. If it's isothermal plus a component that's late infall, then it's this Maxwellian with another peak over here. It's great fun, and I look forward to doing it. In this case, I actually did both. If you look here, there's kind of two types of cross-hatching, and it tells you. So the upper one is most vanilla, kind of most pessimistic model of dark matter distribution, and then a slightly less pessimistic but not crazy narrow one is a slightly lower limit. We actually have a paper out that came out shortly after this that talks about more exotic distribution where axions are really quite cold, and then we get near the DFS Z limits in those particular models.
Any other questions for Greg?
Yeah. Where are these axions coming from? Are they coming from, you know, just backgrounds, or are they coming specifically from cosmic rays?
They're dark matter.
So it's everywhere.
They're just, you know, they're a collisionless gas that's surrounding our galaxy, and so we're just sort of drifting through it.
So if there are any other questions, it's time for you.